This is the state of things from the Upstage Cabaret, a Triad stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. You know, the black struggle for education is often centered on the fight for integration. However, less attention is paid to the long civil rights movement that built the foundation for cases like Brown versus the Board of Education. The fight for black education had to be negotiated during the age of separate but equal. Black communities in the 1960s were demanding access to higher education and equality of curricula and teacher salaries. Sarah Tucson is a professor of history at Guilford College and the author of the new book, Greater Than Equal, African American Struggles for Schools and Citizenship in North Carolina, 1919 to 1965, and she's here to tell us more about it. Welcome, Sarah. Good to have you here. So I understand that you're partially inspired to even investigate this story when you were comparing your mother's experiences in education.
Right. I think my interest in this topic in many ways does reflect my generational vantage point. I think like a lot of children of the post-1960s South, it was hard not to be struck as a student of history by the difference one generation can make, the difference one generation can make in terms of the possibilities for change as well as the possibilities for the reversal of change. I need not look back more than one generation to hear stories about a strictly segregated school system. When my mother started first grade in 1943 in South Carolina, she, of course, was attending a strictly segregated school system. When I started first grade in 1979 in North Carolina, the state was reaching historic levels of school integration. And yet, when I was in graduate school in the 1990s, there was already discussion of school resegregation. So I was interested in tracing the roots of some of these rapid shifts. And I thought one way of doing that was listening to the men and women who best understood both the possibilities and the profound limits of the strategy of school equalization.
And that strategy is an interesting one. I think a lot of us take for granted, those of us who grew up in the era of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, take for granted that integration was always the goal. But when Plessy versus Ferguson legalized separate but equal, there was a question about whether we're going for, we'll keep it separate but give us the, you know, but make it equal, a very important question in the minds of African American leaders.
Right. And most of the period that I'm studying here, folks were working strictly within that separate but equal limitation. It wasn't until after Brown and even into the post-Brown period, as we can maybe talk about in a moment, folks were still working in many ways to equalize the segregated schools while simultaneously pushing for integration.
So talk about this long civil rights movement and why you decided to start at 1919 and go study the period 1919 to 65.
Mm-hmm. Well, the phrase long civil rights movement comes from historian Jacqueline Hall, who's at UNC Chapel Hill and founder of the Southern Oral History Program. Several years ago, she urged historians to reframe the narrative of the civil rights movement and to kind of complicate the ways we look at it, to give more attention to its deep roots, as well as to the ways in which folks tried to extend the movement past the 1960s. And so I'm really kind of looking at its deep roots here, which is an important part of this story. I argue that a lot of the ways in which folks were fighting for equalization had a really direct bearing on the ways they later fought for integration, coalitions that were formed, protest strategies that were tried, all in various ways fed into the struggle for integration later.
And tell us about that. For instance, the struggle over an equal curricula or equal curricula so that African Americans would have access to a liberal arts education rather than vocational in post-secondary schools.
Sure. For many years in the late 19th, early 20th century, to the extent that white Southern states were providing public education for African Americans, they often advocated using different curricula in black and white schools. And for black schools, they often advocated for an industrial-based curriculum. And by that, they essentially meant training for sort of menial positions in agriculture and domestic service. It's a complicated story because some African-American educators also advocated for the benefits of an industrial curriculum, but increasingly by the 1920s, they saw the industrial curriculum as something that should be a supplement to black schooling, not as the linchpin of black schooling. And so they began calling for more curricular equality and access to liberal arts training, just like white students had. And in North Carolina, by the mid-1920s, at least one white state official was willing to concede that point, a man by the name of Nathan Newbold, who was director of the Division of Negro Education for many years. He had been influenced by sociologists and anthropologists who were beginning to see racial differences as more cultural ones than innate ones. And so he advocated for curricular equality. But as I point out, in many ways, this was a hollow victory. It was one thing to say, yes, you may permit the same curricula in both black and white schools, but if you don't have the resources to teach it, which black schools often did not, what good is it if you can't teach chemistry if you don't have the lab materials? Also, black educators began to argue, it's not just that we want access to white-authored curricula. We want the right to shape school curriculum. For example, we want to be able to add more black history to their curriculum. And finally, black educators increasingly pointed out in the Depression years, what good is an equalized curriculum in the first place if we don't have an equalized job market? You know, our students, regardless of what kind of training they're receiving, can't find good jobs when they finish school.
So this is interesting. Even in an era when African-American leadership was suggesting that we'll go for the separate part as long as you make it equal, there are the roots then of what we would see as the modern civil rights movement that led to and whose goal was integration, this idea that it's a much broader picture than each of these particulars in isolation.
Right. Eventually, all these separate components of the equalization struggle fed into what became the integration struggle to integrate the schools.
Well, when we look at the complexity of this, I think the story of Thomas Hocut, is that how he pronounced his name? His effort to get into pharmacy school at UNC, I think, shines a light on this.
Right. I mentioned his story in relation to a chapter I have about James Shepherd, the founder of what is now North Carolina Central University. And Shepherd is a very interesting figure. He's a difficult man to characterize. The late historian John Hope Franklin once called Shepherd a very strange man. He said he was a conservative by day and a radical by night. And what he meant by that was Shepherd kind of represented a generation of black institution builders who were left with a dilemma. On the one hand, they wanted to build and expand black institutions that were born out of the oppressiveness of Jim Crow. But on the other hand, they risked breathing new life into Jim Crow by doing that. And indeed, Shepherd helped to block Thomas Hocut's efforts to integrate UNC. Hocut applied to the pharmacy school at UNC in 1933. Hocut previously had been a school at James Shepherd's institution, and Shepherd refused to release Hocut's transcript, thereby really complicating his efforts to get into UNC.
It's interesting, again, this gambit, this really important strategic question, should we stick with the equal part? It might be a lot harder to get these white folks to share their space with us. Let's just make sure they're going to get an equal curricula and an equal share of the wealth. On the other hand, it does suggest, you know, eternal second-class citizenship. So that, if you're African-American leadership, you're struggling with that very important question. How about on the white side? Were there people saying, look, the one way to preserve Jim Crow would be to give them the money? Was there any kind of argument that said, if we start to make things more equal, there will be less pressure on us to integrate?
Sure. One of the reasons, aside from my own personal interest in North Carolina as a native North Carolinian, one of the reasons I chose to study North Carolina is it loomed particularly large in regional debates about school equalization because it was regarded as one of the more progressive southern states. The racial differential in some respects was narrower than in some deep south states. For that reason, the state had this reputation education as being sort of a model for how to perfect this separate but equal schooling. I would hasten to add, however, that did not mean that North Carolina's commitment to Jim Crow was any less solid. In fact, as you're just suggesting, state officials often talked about the only way to preserve Jim Crow is, in one sense, to modernize it.
And one of the ways I think this struggle or the North Carolina's position as a somewhat more progressive southern state shows up is in the struggle for teacher salary equalization. Tell us about that.
Right, right. Well, just to give you your listeners a little background, on the surface, the state claimed during this period that it came up with the salary levels based solely on level of training and experience of teachers. But in fact, for every level of training and experience, black teachers received less money than white teachers. In the early 20th century, the state did this quite explicitly. They distributed salary schedules that gave different levels for black and white teachers. Later on, they began to kind of hide what they were doing in a clever fashion. They had a maximum level salary for each level and a minimum, and it was just customary to give the black teachers a minimum salary. In 1933, the National NAACP had an interest in trying to organize a lawsuit in North Carolina for teacher salary equalization. And they, along with local black leaders, organized this remarkable rally in Raleigh. Actually, we're coming up on the 80th anniversary of that at the end of this month. It was in late October 1933. And over 2,000 teachers showed up for this rally. There was tremendous grassroots effort in joining forces with the National NAACP in doing this. But leaders within the local Black Teachers Association were very cautious about this and ultimately decided that they would prefer to try to negotiate with local officials rather than litigate. And in fact, it's interesting, both white officials and some of the leaders in the Black Teachers Association both criticized the National NAACP for outside agitation.
Outside agitators, yeah.
They did so for different reasons. Yeah. White officials did so because they feared change. Leaders within the Black Teachers Association feared that the National Association's role would impede change.
And this is because, relative to other states, the gap between African-American teachers and whites was somewhat narrower. In other words, you kind of had a little more to lose. If you had a huge gap, then you go for broke. But in fact, because it was a little closer, there was a lot more to weigh in the protest.
I think that's right. I think officials within the Teachers Association felt that they had made some progress, and so they would keep trying the strategy that they had been pursuing.
You were able to look, too, at the talking about the struggle to equalize facilities, and that led to a student strike in Lumberton in 1946, right?
That's right. Of course, we're sitting very close to the location of the Greensboro sit-ins in 1960, and in many ways, this is an earlier example of the power of youthful activism, in this case, even younger people, because we're talking elementary and high school students. In 1946 in Lumberton, there were two black public schools, and they were in horrible condition. They had no indoor plumbing. There were fire traps, rickety buildings. And partly organized by a chapter of the NAACP Youth Council, young people in Lumberton decided to strike. One day they left school in large numbers, and they said, you know, if local officials don't promise us better schools, we'll organize a longer boycott. And so about a week later, when there were no promises of better schools forthcoming, they left school once again, and they didn't return for 9 days. At that point, local officials did promise the improvement of their schools, but it eventually took a lawsuit on the part of several parents before they actually lived up to that promise.
What part do you think that protest played in getting that lawsuit off the ground? Was that in the works, or were parents looking at their kids saying, uh-oh, they're out ahead of us again, we need to get going here?
Right. The lawsuit wasn't in the works at the time of the protest, but developed when it was clear that local officials were going to drag their feet and living up to the promises they'd made to the young people. And so then more parents got involved. The national NAACP got involved, as well as local chapters of the NAACP. In fact, at the time, Thurgood Marshall, chief counsel for the NAACP, said this was the finest thing ever pulled in the NAACP, the strike and the boycott.
Interesting to see, and this is the one thing, one of the many things that your book highlights for us, the complexity of any kind of successful social movement, social political movement. You have on the one hand a kind of activism that wrenches from the power establishment a promise, which they have no intention of delivering on. But once we have the promise, we now have the legal grounds to move forward where we may not have had it absent the protest. And so all of these things are kind of working together. And even under the wrong theory, the theory that we will remain separate, all of that starts to work kind of sideways, forward and backward toward ultimate social progress.
Right. A lot of different elements had to come together at once. Legal leverage, local leverage in terms of negotiations with officials.
So how did the equalization, how did the movement shift from equalization to integration?
Well, it depends on sort of what level you're looking at. The national NAACP began advocating that local chapters shift their fight from equalization to integration as early as 1950. But I looked at local communities and local chapters of the NAACP, and that break from one strategy to the next was not as clean as national leaders had advocated. I found equalization activism persisting into the 1960s, which makes sense. I mean, in one sense, Brown came not at a moment of declension for black schools, but at a moment when they were finally starting to receive a little bit more in the way of state and local funding. It's not that they were ever equalized in terms of conditions, because they were not. But because state officials were fearing the beginnings of integration, they began to pour more money into the schools in the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s. And so local black school communities saw their schools improving. It was hard to give up that struggle to better their schools. Just to give you one example, that in my hometown, I grew up in Hickory, and there you see a new high school wing being added to the 12th-grade black school there as late as 1957. And I interviewed some folks there about that, and they said, oh, yeah, we knew that in one sense this was window dressing. This was a way of kind of covering up for past inequalities and delaying integration. But we had long wanted improvements to our school. You know, who's going to fight that?
Well, now we're seeing, and a lot of folks are saying, we are in an era of resegregation. Is that something you're seeing now?
Well, certainly. It was one of the reasons I got interested in this topic. Since the 90s, in especially southern urban areas, you have seen rising levels of resegregation. Of course, most notably in Wake County in 2009, 2010, there was a huge controversy and debate about that county's decision to get rid of their integration plan and what that would mean for the schools. In a variety of ways, this history I'm writing about infuses current policy debate, and you could argue that at its core, all of those debates center on whether the past that I have written about is really past.
I think it's still with us, and I thank you for bringing it to light. Sarah, thanks so much for being on the program. Sarah Tucson. Sarah is a professor of history at Guilford College, author of Greater Than Equal, African American Struggles for School and Citizenship in North Carolina, 1919 to 1965. We've got the North Carolina UNCG Spartan Jazz Collective with us. You'll hear a little bit from them right now, and then a lot more when we come back. Here they are.